Good evening, everyone. This is Luke Caverly, and you're listening to the Divided Kingdom radio show. Well, here we are, March 3rd, as I record this. You'll be hearing it March 5th or 7th, depending upon which day you tune in. And, of course, the big news is what's going on in Iran. I want to lead off with an article that kind of shows where things were at a week and a half ago and gives a little hint as to why President Trump might have authorized these strikes when he did. And then I'll have some comments. This was from the Washington Times. It was dated Sunday, February 22nd, so about a week and a half ago, not quite 2 weeks. The headline reads, Witkoff says Iran a week away from having enough enriched uranium for a bomb. It was by Mike Glenn, again, the Washington Times, February 22nd. White House Special Envoy Steve Witkoff is warning that Iran is about a week away from having enough enriched uranium to create at least one nuclear bomb. Mr. Witkoff said Tehran has been enriching uranium at up to the 60% level, well beyond the capacity needed for civilian use, as the regime has claimed. The Islamic Republic has not enriched uranium at the 90% weapons-grade level, but it has amassed a substantial stockpile of 60% enriched uranium, he said. That's about 90% of the work required to reach 90% purity, analysts say. Mr. Witkoff said Saturday on Fox News Channel's My View, quote, that's really dangerous, so we can't have that, unquote. President Trump wants to know why Iranian leaders are continuing to dig in their heels over developing a nuclear arsenal despite the growing U.S. military presence in the region. Mr. Witkoff said, quote, with the amount of sea power and naval power that we have over there, why haven't they come to us and said, we don't want a weapon, so here's what we're prepared to do. Yet, it's hard to get them to that place, unquote. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian said Saturday that Tehran would not bow to international pressure or internal dissent. Despite the obstacles, he said, Iran has the will and the ability to fight back. All right, I'm going to cut that short. There's more to the article, but as we all know now, here it is, March 3rd, Tuesday, and the Iranian Navy has pretty much been destroyed. The Iranian Air Force has pretty much been destroyed, so they are at the mercy of Israel and the United States. Now, we might ask, why now? Why did President Trump decide this was the time? Well, perhaps this article gives a clue. Now, a year or two ago, Mr. Trump said that the Iranian capacity to make an atomic bomb had been eliminated. But perhaps that was a bit wishful thinking. I don't know. I have a feeling that Mr. Trump knows a great many things we don't know. And it stands to reason that the enriching of uranium is one clue that they do not want to compromise. I should say they did not want to compromise because now it's too late. And you have to remember, too, that Iran is not like most other countries. It's run by a group of religious fanatics, Muslim fanatics, who want nothing more than to destroy Israel and the United States. And we get the impression sometimes that they are suicidal, that they would gladly destroy their whole country if they could destroy Israel and the USA. After all, they've called us the Great Satan. And the events seem to be bearing that out. The head of Iran is now dead. And news had just come in this morning that the council that was going to choose the next leader for Iran is also dead. That a strike wiped them all out. So we don't know all that goes on. We're also reminded that if Iran got a nuclear weapon, they would probably use it to at least get one or two U.S. cities if they could. I'm not sure they have the capability to do that. And they would probably strike Israel, because that is one of the big things that they have claimed time and time and time again, that they want to destroy Israel. And it wouldn't surprise me if they would take the suicidal approach that even if Israel has atomic bombs, and they probably do, they are willing to take that chance and have themselves annihilated just so they can destroy Israel. That's how fanatic they are. And events seem to be bearing that out. Also, in the last few weeks, it seems like they've been just kind of stringing things along, trying to postpone any compromise. And I think Mr. Trump finally decided that it was taking too much of a chance with this possibility of a nuclear weapon in Iran. That's just my own interpretation. And, of course, we don't know all the things that are going on. But those of us that have studied World War II remember that Adolf Hitler, time and time and time again in the 1930s, said when he seized this or did this in violation of treaties, this is my last, how did he put it, my last objective in Europe. When he demilitarized or entered troops into the demilitarized zone of the Rhineland, and I think it was 1935 or maybe 36, when he raised up a strong army in defiance of the Versailles Treaty, when he created an air force in defiance of that treaty, when he went into Austria and then threatened so much that they compromised and said he could take part of Czechoslovakia. Well, the next spring he took it all. And finally, the leaders in England, who had been trying to placate Adolf Hitler, said enough is enough. But by then it was very late. And in the spring of 1939, after the Munich crisis, Prime Minister Chamberlain finally gave a guarantee to Poland. And of course, Hitler promptly invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939, starting World War II. So it may be a lesson to be learned there that you may try to placate dictators, but you can't trust what they say. All right, enough of that. Let me see now. We still have some evidence that the major media can't stand Trump, wants to get at him, wants to minimize his effect. And here's a little article. The other one, by the way, just to finish it up, was from the Washington Times on Sunday, February 22nd. This one is from the New York Post, Monday, March 2nd. And the title says, CBS Austin reporter brushes off directive to downplay pro-Trump rally after Iran strikes. Quote, they don't want us to focus on this, unquote. This is by Ariel Zilber. A CBS Austin reporter was seen on a live Facebook stream appearing to get a directive from a superior to steer away from a pro-Israel, pro-U.S., and pro-Trump protest behind him, and then refusing to go along with the instruction on camera. Vinny Martorano was outside the Texas Capitol on Saturday covering dueling demonstrations in the wake of the U.S. and Israeli strikes in Iran, when a crew member handed him a phone with a message from an unnamed boss. After reading the screen, the reporter asked out loud, what does this mean? Vinny Martorano, who is a reporter for CBS Austin, appears on a Facebook live stream outside the Texas Capitol building as demonstrators wave Iranian and American flags behind him. An off-screen staffer answered, quote, it means they don't want us to focus on this, unquote. Well, I am, Martorano shot back, continuing his coverage. Sinclair Broadcasting Group, which owns CBS Austin, insisted Martorano had not been instructed to avoid certain perspectives. A Sinclair spokesperson told the Post in an email, quote, station management directed the crew to follow our standard protests and rallies safely, and I guess that's all part of the same thing. to follow our standard protest and rally safety and coverage guidelines, remain on the perimeter, get the necessary content, complete the live shot, and move to a safe location. There was no directive to avoid or de-emphasize any particular perspective, the spokesperson added. The guidance was focused on safety, logistics, and ensuring comprehensive coverage in a rapidly evolving situation. The safety of our teams is top priority, unquote. The moment was clipped down to roughly 35 seconds and quickly went viral as it got reshared by conservative social media accounts. The exchange was seen as evidence the media were trying to bury a show of support for President Trump and the military action. All right. Well, it wouldn't surprise us. We've seen how the major media is just, anytime they can, it seems they are minimizing anything good that Trump has done. Going on with the article a little bit later, Martorano was handed a phone by a crew member during a live stream, and that is a little bit repetitive. The people behind him or near him with demonstrators waving Iranian flags and chanting, "Thank you, Mr. Trump, and thank you, Bibi," a reference to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Martorano keeps the camera trained in a pro-Trump rally that erupted after news broke that Ayatollah Ali Khamenei had been killed. The crowd appears to include members of the Iranian diaspora, waving pre-1979 Lion and Sun Iranian flags, along with U.S. flags. Several people were seen holding posters of Reza Pahlavi, the former crown prince of Iran. Sinclair runs dozens of local affiliates around the country. The posters sought comment from the station. And the rest we already know about. And, of course, as we said a few minutes ago, updating it for March 3rd, Israel struck at the Iran Supreme Council that was meaning to vote a new leader. And the reports say all those in that council were killed. So there won't be a new leader right away. A lot of the Iranians who had fled from this repressive regime would like to see their crown prince back in power. Others would like to see others. But a great large part of the population, perhaps 90%, preferred not to ever go back to this Ayatollah business. So that was the New York Post. On Tuesday, make that Monday, March 2nd, 2026. Now, if you're listening, you might like to contact me, Blue Cavalry, and to do so, you can write to me. My name is Lou, L-O-U, Cavalry, C-A-V-E-R-L-Y. You can write to Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, and the zip code is 21609. So that's Lou Cavalry, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And I will try my best to respond to every one of you that writes. I'm getting a little behind. Those of you that have sent some very nice donations that are very helpful and other good comments, I apologize for being a little behind. We've had all kinds of things happening, but I will try and get caught up in the next few days. And I thank you so much for your donations. Those are always deeply appreciated. They've fallen off a little bit during the winter, and now I think they're beginning to come back up, which is a great help because I just don't have the money to finance the program myself. I depend upon people like you out there to give the wherewithal to keep this program going. And our website. Now, my website, sad to say that Elizabeth is no longer with us. It's been just a year since she passed away. But I hope that she is able to hear this program in heaven now. So the website is DividedKingdomRadio.com. All one word, DividedKingdomRadio.com. If you go to that, you can find out the various ways you can hear the program. That website also has the archive. So if you miss a program, you can go to the archives and hear it just by choosing the proper date for the program you missed. We're on Thursday evenings on WWCR.com. That's short for Worldwide Christian Radio. And that's at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Soon it'll be Eastern Daylight Savings Time in just about a week. And the frequency, if you want to hear it on shortwave, is 4.840 megahertz. 4.840. That's 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Thursdays. And it repeats Saturday mornings at 8 a.m. And the frequency there is 4.790. Now, some of you may have said to me in letters that the reception hasn't been as good. That often happens right around the time of when the sun is getting higher in the sky, or in the autumn when it's getting lower. When the time is about to change, a lot of times that introduces some periods near sunset or sunrise where the reception for a time is not as good, but try to bear with it. And don't forget, if you have a computer, you can always, or a cell phone, you can always get it by means of going to WWCR.com. And I think it's transmitter 3. I'm not positive about that. But if you choose the correct time, it should be obvious. Well, that's a little background information. We've been having this program up until our death. I had it with Elizabeth for several years. I don't know exactly how many now. But we've been doing it in one form or another for, well, I guess it's almost two decades now. Maybe even a little beyond that. Elizabeth always used to know these exact things. I would have to look it up to tell you the truth. Well, now what else do we have here? Let's get something that's a little different for a change of pace. We may come back to some of the war stories. But how about from the Gateway Pundit? Liberal mega donor Steven Spielberg reportedly fleeing California as Gavin Newsom's billionaire wealth tax looms. This is by Jim Hoft, February 22nd, the Gateway Pundit. Now, you might remember from a week or two back, I talked about this wealth tax. As I understand it, it's a tax on your total wealth. It's not like income. Income tax is the money you brought in this year. For those of us who are about to fill it out, that would be last year, 2025. This is the tax on everything you own. And, of course, if you're a billionaire, that can be a substantial amount of money. So, let me read this. For years, Hollywood elite Steven Spielberg has been one of the biggest cheerleaders for the radical left, dumping millions into Democrat coffers and supporting the very quote-unquote progressive policies that have turned California into a high-tax, crime-ridden wasteland. Reports are surfacing that Spielberg is officially ditching the Golden State, just as Governor Gavin Newsom and his Marxist allies in Sacramento push for a massive, one-time, 5% wealth tax on billionaires. For a man who is worth an estimated $7.1 billion, that comes out to be a whopping $355 million that he'll have to write a check for to the state of California. That's a lot of money. When I think to myself, as most of you will, what could we do with $355 million? I put no windows in my house. Minor deteriorating. I would, I get a couple of books I want. I go out to the restaurants once or twice a month, maybe even more, because I get fat then. But all kidding aside, that's a lot of money. According to multiple reports, Spielberg and his wife, actress Kate Capshaw, became official residents of New York City on January 1st, 2026, after leaving their longtime home base in California. The timing is raising serious questions, and for good reason. California's far left is currently pushing a controversial billionaire tax act that would slap a one-time 5% wealth tax on residents whose net worth exceeds $1 billion. The proposed measure could impact more than 200 billionaires. Gosh, I didn't know there were that many, even in California. And that's just in the state of California. And it's being considered, this measure, this act, for the November 2026 ballot. Apparently it's going to be a referendum, I guess. Spielberg's spokesperson told the LA Times that the move was long planned and solely about being closer to grandchildren in New York. Fox News reported Steven Spielberg and his wife, Kate Capshaw, officially became New York residents on January 1st, according to a report by the Los Angeles Times. The couple relocated to the San Remo co-op on Central Park West in Manhattan, which has previously housed celebrities including Bono, Mick Jagger, Warren Beatty, and Tiger Woods. On the same day that Spielberg reportedly established a residency, his production company, Amblin Entertainment, opened an office in New York City, marking a notable transition away from Hollywood. Speculation around the timing of the move can be linked to the proposed wealth tax. Let's see now. While it has not yet qualified for the November ballot, the proposal, backed by the Service Employees International Union, United Healthcare Workers West, would take effect in 2027. I may have read a little bit of this before. Now, it does seem familiar, or another version of it. Well, on the one hand, you figure a billionaire can afford that without much strain. If I can pay, you know, a substantial part of my income, they ought to be paying too. But the problem is, of course, that you can't force people to stay in California. And a lot of these billionaires don't like this idea. They may just move like Spielberg did, out of state, to Texas, New York, Idaho, wherever. So it may backfire. And they may lose a great deal more than they think they're going to gain. Well, we shall see, and we'll see if that passes in the referendum in the fall. That, by the way, was from the Gateway Pundit about Steven Spielberg. It was by Jim Hoft, February 22nd, 2026. All right. Now, going back a little bit to military matters, we have from the WorldNet Daily, Wokeness and Weakness. Pete Hegseth cancels War Department involvement with biased universities. And the word biased is in quotes. This is by Bob Unruh, WorldNet Daily, March 1st. U.S. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth has canceled the department's involvement in a number of, quote, biased, unquote, universities. The confirmation involves the end of tuition assistance and other War Department subsidies for Princeton, Columbia, MIT, Brown, Yale, and others starting in the 2026-2027 school year. It involves the, quote, complete and immediate cancellation of all Department of War attendance, unquote, at the schools. And a report from the Washington Examiner says, a source familiar with the matter told CNN that this entails the cessation of tuition assistance for schools deemed biased against the U.S. military and sponsoring, quote, troublesome partnerships with foreign adversaries, unquote, as detailed in a memo signed by Hegseth. All graduate-level professional military education fellowships and certificate programs at these universities for active duty service members will be cut. And that, again, was a report from the Washington Examiner. Hegseth said the schools, considered among the nation's elite institutions, replaced, quote, the study of victory and pragmatic realism with a promotion of wokeness and weakness, unquote. And it went on to say, senior service colleges have always been expected to act in the interest of this principle, to transform our senior warfighters into strategic thinkers capable of mastering the complexities of modern warfare and leading our joint force to victory at every echelon. Unfortunately, and this is part of the quote, this sacred trust has been broken in the military's professional military education system. It's been poisoned from within by a class of so-called elite universities who abuse their privilege and access to this department and utterly betrayed their purpose. And that was the end of the quote. It goes on to say they've used a charge, taxpayer dollars, to become, quote, factories of anti-American resentment and military disdain. And I'll stop there with that article. That gives you the main part of it. Well, I think in large part he's right. When you see some of the demonstrations by some of the, let's just call them characters and students at these universities, you wonder, how in the world do they get these people going there? A lot of them are foreign students, of course. And I was just reading a book about, the title is The Making of the Atomic Bomb by Richard Rhodes. At that time, and of course it was during wartime, World War II, the Manhattan Project had several college professors from big-name universities like James B. Conant from Harvard, who was very high up in the Manhattan Project. Powell Compton, I think he was the president of the MIT, and a number of others. And of course, many of those scientists had fled Europe because of the repression of science and of Jewish scientists in particular. Although many of the non-Jewish scientists were also kicked out or deprived of their jobs if they didn't toe the line of the Nazis. Albert Einstein was wise enough to get out while the getting was good. He left before the worst persecutions began, although they were hinted at in Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler, and a number of others. Enrico Fermi was not Jewish, but his wife was, and he got out of Italy just in time. And there were many others, Leo Szilard, quite a number of the famous scientists who contributed to the building of the atomic bomb. And you wonder, with today's universities, would any of the leaders of those universities or distinguished professors have helped out? Or would they have just chanted and just said, down with the USA? Huh. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? That article was from WorldNet Daily about Pete Hegseth and the universities, dated March the 1st, 2026. Well, now, a little relief from that. For years and years and years, I have been interested in this mystery. Everybody loves a good mystery. And I don't know how many of you recognize the name D.B. Cooper. But that's one of the great mysteries of the last half of the 20th century. So, without further delay, from Fox News, this is by Sarah Rumpf-Whitten. Published March 3rd, and the headline says, FBI files reveal new D.B. Cooper suspect, Maine pilot once investigated in skyjacking mystery. A newly released batch of FBI investigative files in the long-unsolved D.B. Cooper hijacking case shows that agents once examined a former pilot from Western Maine as a possible suspect. The files, released by the FBI, indicate that Raymond Sidney Russell, who also went by R. Sid Russell and Sid Russell, was interviewed by the Bureau in 1972 as part of their effort to identify the man who hijacked a Northwest Orient Airlines flight in November 1971. I'll interject, we're talking, what is that now? That must be 55 years ago. And he collected $200,000 in ransom and parachuted from the plane somewhere over the Pacific Northwest. The hijacker was never caught, and the case remains one of the FBI's most infamous unsolved mysteries. The Portland Press Herald says that Russell, a Norway, Maine native born in 1923, served in the military and later worked in aviation, including time with the Flying Tigers and other freight airlines. He had lived in the West Coast before returning to Maine in 1971. And for those of you who may not be familiar with the name Flying Tigers, they were American volunteers before the U.S. got into World War II, before Pearl Harbor. They were helping, helping the Chinese to fight off the Japanese invaders. Back to the article, the FBI, this is a caption for a picture. The FBI released these sketches, and if you go to the website, you can actually see them. After a man named D.B. Cooper hijacked a plane flying from Portland to Seattle on November 24th, 1971, and then parachuted out the back door with $200,000, never to be seen again. The files do not specify how Russell first drew investigators' attention, but the documents show agents reviewed his background and interviewed him at his home in September 1972. During that interview, Russell reportedly denied any involvement in the hijacking and said he had returned to Maine months before the crime to be with his mother. According to the newspaper, some of the people agents spoke with believed Russell could have committed the crime, while others did not think he was capable of it. The newly released portion of the file includes a handwritten notation dated November 1972 that reads, "Eliminate Russell," suggesting the Bureau decided not to pursue him further. Ryan Burns, a Mississippi criminal defense attorney who runs a YouTube channel called D.B. Cooper Sleuth and attends an annual Cooper-focused gathering known as CooperCon, told the Portland Press Herald that he has reviewed all the FBI's released files. And here's a quote from Burns, Ryan Burns. "It's kind of the coolest crime ever. This guy is wearing sunglasses, smoking cigarettes, drinking bourbon in the back of a plane. And he got away with it." And I'll just interject, because I don't think it gives too much detail here. As I recall, the man who called himself G.B. Cooper, and that was not his real name, hijacked the plane, talked to the stewardesses and the rest of the pilots, hijacked the plane. I think it landed somewhere. I don't think it says where here in the Pacific Northwest. And he demanded that they supply the $200,000. They did. The government did. They took off and ended up that he bailed out with a parachute, which I think he also demanded to have a parachute. He bailed out. The airline returned to whatever airport it was scheduled to go to, and he was never seen again. Now, some of the money was apparently recovered, and I may tell more about that as I read down further. But it, to this day, is an unsolved mystery. And whether or not this author has hit on it, I don't know. But let me read on a little bit. Burns said roughly 24 people have appeared to have investigated as seriously as Russell, or have been investigated as seriously as Russell. The expert said that he doesn't believe Russell was the hijacker, citing differences between Russell's physical characteristics and witness descriptions of Cooper. He also noted that despite decades of investigation, he doubts the case will ever be solved, in part because potential DNA evidence may have been destroyed. "I don't think, and this is in quotes, I don't think anybody in the world wants to solve more than I do, given all the effort I put into it," Burns told the newspaper. And it shows, if you go to the website, it shows a picture of some of the money in a badly deteriorated state that actually matched the random money. As I recall, it was found on the ground sometime after. And if you just go to the internet and type in initials D as in dog, as in boy, Cooper, you'll quickly find umpteen references to this hijacking and mystery. Let's see. Records reviewed by the newspaper show Russell was a standout high school skier in Norway. That's Norway, Maine. And later received a $5,000 state grant in the late 1980s for an invention. He died in 1989 and is buried in Paris, Maine. The FBI redacted the names of witnesses and acquaintances interviewed in connection with Russell. That, of course, means that they scratched him out so he can't see the names. Fox News Digital has reached out to the FBI for comment on the case. And on the website, which is foxnews.com, it shows a picture of a canvas bag that contained one of the parachutes given to D.B. Cooper in 1971. According to the FBI, Cooper asked for four chutes in all. He jumped with two, including one that was used for instruction and had been sewn shut. He used the cord from one of the remaining parachutes to tie the stolen money bag shut. More than five decades after the hijacking, the Cooper case continues to draw fascination, inspiring books and movies, despite thousands of pages of released documents and countless theories. The identity of the man who successfully hijacked the commercial aircraft remains a mystery. And that was from Fox News, foxnews.com, by Sarah Rumpf, R-U-M-P-H. No, I'm sorry, R-U-M-P-F. Witten, published March 3rd, 2026. And I should add that a lot of people felt that Cooper, or the man calling himself Cooper, would have been killed parachuting up because he would have landed in one of the most inhospitable areas of the Pacific Northwest. Others, however, say he might very well have succeeded in what he set out to do. And no body was ever found. Some of the money was found, but I don't think it was in circulation. I think it was found on the ground, where it might have been spilled, dumped, or whatever. Well, if you're interested, you can go to many, many websites and just type in D as in dog, B as in bacon, Cooper, and you will find tons of stuff. Very interesting case. Everybody likes a good mystery, and that's certainly one of the best. Now, let's see. Next, we have from WorldNet Daily. Terror Nexus. Mass shooter at Austin, Texas bar identified. Wore property of Allah hoodie and Iranian flag t-shirt. This is by Joe Kovacs, WorldNet Daily, March 1st, 2026. The mass shooter who killed at least two people and injured 14 others in an Austin, Texas bar early Sunday has been identified as a naturalized citizen from Senegal in Africa who wore an undershirt with an Iranian flag on it and a hoodie with the message, Property of Allah. The bloodshed that broke out just before 2 a.m. at Buford's Backyard Beer Garden near the University of Texas Austin took place within hours of the U.S. military's Operation Epic Fury against Iran. The gunman, who had a Koran in his car, was ultimately shot and killed by local police. He has been named as 53-year-old Niaga Diagne. And I know I'm massacring the pronunciation. He was a former New York City resident who was living in Pflugerville, Texas. The FBI is now investigating Sunday morning's horror as a potential act of terrorism. Well, not much more to say about that. It has a few other quotes, but it's an ongoing investigation. Let's see now. U.S. Representative Michael McCaul, Republican of Texas, a member of the House Homeland Security Committee, addressed the bloodshed at the bar and blasted Democrats in Congress as, quote, grossly irresponsible, unquote, for delaying funding for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. He told Harris Faulkner of Fox News, quote, In my backyard, just last night, we had an event that possibly could have been terror-inspired right here in Austin, Texas. It's the same city where the would-be assassin of the Saudi Arabia ambassador in the Georgetown restaurant came out of. This concerns me on the homeland front with regard to sleeper cells in the U.S. from Iran that may try to hit the target first. I see it as a real threat across the country, and it is so irresponsible to hold up that funding, unquote. All right, Will Net Daily was the source of that one. Joe Kovacs was the author. March 1st was the date. And again, if you'd like to write to me with your comments, contributions are always welcome. Write to me at Lou Caverly, and you spell that C-A-V-E-R-L-Y, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Now, here's a little something about the Texas Rangers from the Western Journal. Statue that was taken down during woke witch hunts of 2020 has been restored. A Victory for Police, Texas, and America by Jack Davis, March 3rd. The Texas Rangers baseball team has brought back into the public eye a statue that was hidden away 6 years ago. On Monday, the team unveiled the, and this is in quotes, One Riot, One Ranger statue at Globe Life Field in honor of the Texas Rangers Law Enforcement Agency, according to the Dallas Morning News. The statue had been installed at Dallas Love Field until 2020, when it was removed amid allegations of racism in the history of the Law Enforcement Agency. Russell Molina, board member of the Texas Ranger Association Foundation, said in a statement, quote, "We recognize that the history of the Texas Rangers, like that of our state and nation, includes moments that must be confronted honestly. While not everyone who has served across more than two centuries lived up to the ideal, most did. And they deserve to be remembered for that service, sacrifice, and commitment to the people of Texas," unquote. The statue was donated to the city of Dallas in 1961. When it was removed, author Douglas Swanson said the model for the statue had been involved in state-led efforts to oppose integration. Molina disputed that contention. The base of the statue says, "Texas Ranger of 6060. Make that 1960, along with the quote, "One Riot, One Ranger." After its removal, the statue was slated to be part of a museum at Waco that never came to be. The Texas Ranger Association Foundation and the baseball team, that would be the Texas Rangers, talked of having the statue at the Rangers' home field, and it was brought there Monday after being stored at Alliance Airport in Fort Worth. The informal "One Riot, One Ranger" slogan attributed to the agency is believed to have grown from an 1896 comment from Rangers captain William McDonald, who was sent to break up an illegal prize fight. When asked where others were, McDonald allegedly replied, "Hell, I ain't enough. There's only one prize fight." And Ray Davis, the majority owner of the Rangers team, said on Monday, quote, "Our charter is a baseball club, and our foundation is we support the following segments of our society. First, it's kids, and that's where our focus is. Second is our first responders, and the last is our law enforcement. And in Texas, the point of the spear for our law enforcement are the Texas Rangers. We're very proud to be associated with them, and we hope that the over 6 million people who come through our stadium will view what you see here today," he said. Molina said, according to WFAA-TV, "This statue represents all Texas Rangers, not any single individual. The modern Texas Ranger reflects the diversity, integrity, and professionalism expected of one of the nation's oldest and most respected law enforcement organizations." As Davis noted, "We have worn the Rangers' name since 1972 with pride." All All right. So that was in the Western Journal by Jack Davis, March 3rd. Now we have several other things here. In Maryland, a redistricting plan that would strip those of us who happen to vote Republican on the Eastern Shore and a certain part of the Western Shore of Maryland on a little bit of both sides of Chesapeake Bay. Currently, Andy Harris is our U.S. representative, a Republican. He's been there for several terms in the House of Representatives. But the Democrats, who hold the majority in the state legislature of Maryland, are doing one of these gerrymandering things, or trying to at least. It hasn't passed yet, to the best of my knowledge. And the governor, Wes Moore, who I thought I liked, but now I'm not at all sure, he has been supporting this idea to take away by changing the boundaries of the District 1 for the state of Maryland. He's trying to take away the one, I think it's the one Republican vote in the U.S. House of Representatives from Maryland. I don't think there are any other Republicans. I would have to check on that. Anyway, I believe the Maryland Senate leader, although a Democrat, has said it's not going to pass. He's opposed to it. So good for him. But a lot of these states now are having all this flurry of activity trying to stack the deck, mainly by Democrats, but there are a few Republicans as well, stacking the deck so that they can get more of their party in power and basically reduce the other party to practically non-existence. Here's one from Fox News about New York State. Supreme Court sides with New York Republican in congressional redistricting fight. This is published March 3rd, 2026, by Greg Norman Diamond of Fox News. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of a Republican representative from New York challenging a congressional redistricting effort, and in its decision, she said, quote, helps restore the public's confidence in our judicial system, unquote. Over the dissent of the court's three liberal justices, the conservative majority altered a state court ruling that had ordered New York's redistricting commission to redraw the district held by Representative Nicole Meliotakis, Republican of New York, that covers Staten Island and a small piece of Brooklyn. A judge had ruled that the district was drawn in a way that dilutes the power of its black and Hispanic voters and had instructed the state's independent redistricting commission to complete a new map. And now, Ms. Meliotakis said in a statement, quote, today's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to keep New York's the 11th congressional district intact helps restore the public's confidence in our judicial system and proves the challenge to our district lines was always meritless. The plaintiffs in this case attempted to manipulate our state's courts to use race as a weapon to rig our elections. That was wrong, and as demonstrated by today's ruling, clearly unconstitutional. Unfortunately, the politicization of New York's courts and its judges necessitated action from the nation's highest court. I thank the justices who stopped the voters on Staten Island and on southern Brooklyn from being stripped of their ability to elect a representative that reflects their values. And Ms. Meliotakis added, whether I serve another term in Congress is a decision for the voters, not Democrat Party bosses and their high-priced lawyers. In October 2025, New York voters sued state election officials in the Supreme Court of New York, the state's trial court, to challenge the district's lines. Meliotakis intervened to defend the current map. Well, that gives you the idea. And I'll keep you posted about my home state of Maryland, my present home state. As many of you know, my original home state was Massachusetts, and there's all kind of bundling things going on up there, too. But we'll get to that more next week. What else do we have here? Here's another Supreme Court item from the Gateway Pundit, March 2nd, by Christina Layla. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday blocked California's secret gender transition policies for children and said the law likely violated parental rights. The High Court, in a 6-3 vote, allowed a lower court's ruling in favor of parents who reject the evil policy on religious grounds. It's a little awkward sentence. The gist of it is, it allows the lower court's ruling to stand. Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson dissented. NBC News reported, the Supreme Court on Monday barred California from enforcing state rules that restrict when schools can notify parents about students who come out as transgender and requires teachers to use children's preferred pronouns. The court, on a 6-3 vote on ideological lines, allowed a federal judge's ruling in favor of parents who oppose the policy on religious grounds to go into effect. The San Francisco-based 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals had put the judge's decision on hold pending further litigation. The court's ruling focused on the parents' claim that their rights under the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution, First Amendment, were violated. The court did not grant a similar request made by teachers who objected the policy. And the court said, in an unsigned opinion, we conclude that the parents who seek religious exemptions are likely to succeed on the merits of their Free Exercise Clause claim. And the court added, the parents who assert a free exercise claim have sincere religious beliefs about sex and gender, and they feel a religious obligation to raise their children in accordance with those beliefs. So that's a victory for those of us who don't believe in some of this wild transgender stuff for children. I've often said, adults, that's different. Adults, let them do as they please, even if I don't like it. But children, that's a whole different story. Well, we've got a few minutes left. Let's see what else we have here. Sometimes I get things from LifeSite News, which is actually out of Canada. So here's something just to talk about our neighbors to the north. The preceding one, by the way, is from the Gateway Pundit on March 2nd. This one, as I said, is from LifeSite News by Jonathan Van Maren. Monday, February 23rd, 2026. Liberals, now that's a political party, not just a label the way it might be down here in the USA. In Canada, liberals is a political party. They bring back bill that could criminalize quoting Bible and homosexuality despite massive pushback. Bill C-9, the Carney government's hate speech bill that would remove protections for religious speech, was back on the agenda for today's Justice Committee meeting. Conservative Member of Parliament Andrew Lawton, one of the bill's most prominent critics, tabled a petition signed by thousands of Canadians opposing it earlier this month. Bill C-9 is back on the agenda for tomorrow's Justice Committee meeting. And again, I'll see if I can come up with a update on that. This article was dated February 23rd. And Jonathan says, I have heard from thousands of Canadians concerned about how this bill infringes on freedom of expression and religious freedom. Oh, now I take that back. I guess this is a tweet or some sort of a quote by Andrew Lawton. And he goes on to say, I was proud to table a petition on their behalf earlier this month. I think the word table is being used here differently from what I'm used to. Usually when you say if you table it, you mean you postpone it indefinitely. But here it must mean that you bring it to the people's attention. He goes on to say, I'm proud to rise on behalf of Canadians including in my own constituency, who are alarmed by what the government is doing through Bill C-9, a bill that they claim will protect communities from hate, but in actuality exposes faith communities to harm from the government for daring to express their faith and quote religious texts, Lawton told the House of Commons. Again, this is in Canada. The petitioners are very concerned by this infringement on religious liberty, which were aggravated, of course, by comments from the Minister for Canadian Identity and Culture, arguing that there should be prosecution for citing certain religious texts. Lawton continued, so petitioners are calling for the government, or calling on the government, to withdraw Bill C-9 and focus on upholding freedom of expression and freedom of religion. And Lawton was referring to comments made by Liberal Minister Mark Miller, who last October said that good faith, and that's in quotes, good faith defenses of hate speech were indefensible under Canadian law during discussions at the Justice Committee. It was revealing that the go-to example was passages from Scripture. And here's a quote by Mr. Miller. In Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Romans, and there's other passages, there's clear hatred towards, for example, homosexuals, Miller claimed. Well, it goes on. There's quite a bit here. You might want to check out this article. Now, Miller, this is the liberal guy, has denied that he wishes to prohibit certain religious texts. But the government's track record makes it clear that the liberals, can't say that, liberals cannot be trusted on this file. Well, that you can find if you want to get the details, and it's a much longer article. You can find that at LifeSite News, LifeSiteNews.com. And the date was February 23rd, 2026. Well, we will see how things go in Iran. By this time next week, we'll know a lot more about it. Thank you for listening tonight. If you want to contact me, again, the address is Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. I want to thank you all for listening. This is Lou Caraveli. I hope that you will tune in again next week. Good night.